It was this very, you know, hopeful message. And the whole time I'm just like, you know, like,
right.
How much do I pay you? Like, how does this work?
Right.
And I was so excited and it was freaking magical. You know, I'll never forget.
Episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.
Okay.
What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Third edition is out now everywhere. Hardcover, ebook, audiobook, however you like to consume books, you can find that book wherever you find the books. Today, my guest is Dana Nielsen. He is an engineer, a producer, a mixing engineer, artist, songwriter. He's most well known as an engineer and mixing engineer. He mixed a few tracks on SZA's Grammy winning album, SOS. Number one charting album, SOS, a few songs on that. He has worked with, he's either engineered or mixed or been part of Linkin Park, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Rihanna, Nicki Minaj, Madison Ryan Ward, the Avett Brothers, Metallica, Weezer, Post Malone, Adele. I mean, the list goes on. Damien Rice, Justin Timberlake. It's on and on. Black Sabbath. Bob Dylan, I can't skip over Bob Dylan. We spent, for those of you who are the gearheads, the technical ones of the bunch, this episode is for you. We spent a lot of time kind of talking about, you know, kind of how he got into these rooms, how he got his start moving to LA and then ended up in rooms with Rick Rubin. Rick Rubin was has been a big collaborator with Rick Rubin, who has kind of brought him into a lot of these sessions, and how he got a lot of these gigs and then turned into these roles and these jobs, and kind of growing from editor to engineer to second engineer, lead engineer, mixing engineer, all of that, and what those roles are, how much they pay. If you're curious about the business around this, because guess what? This is the New Music Business podcast. We do stick around till the end, and we do dig into the business of all of us, how much each of these roles pay. We talk about points. We talk about, you know, back-end royalties, front-end, all of that stuff. So stick around. And Dana has a very interesting story and fascinating trajectory of all of this. So for those of you that are the studio heads and want to kind of learn how this major label recording studio system works, Dana's done it all, and he steps you through it. And he also does the indie realm. You know, he does his own music. He helps indie artists. I do want to plug, he's got a community called Mix Protégé and some courses there. So you can go check it out at mixprotege.com. You can also find Dana Nielsen at dananielsen.com. He is also one of our star students as part of Ari's Take Academy. For the Ari's Take Academy students that are listening, you know Dana because he's in our community group helping people out. And honestly, Dana is one of the warmest people. And he's so generous with his knowledge and his wisdom. And he's always going above and beyond, just supporting the community at large. He's been supporting our Ari's Take Academy community. It's been a real privilege and honor to have him as part of our community and academy, and to chat with him today on this. So I think you're really going to enjoy this one. You can find all of us at Ari's Take on Instagram, TikTok, X, Threads. You can find me at Ari Herstand on Instagram. Visit aristake.com. Get on that email list. That's where you can get the most up-to-date relevant information about the new music business. But right now, if you could just pause this real quick, give us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, however you're listening to this right now, give us a thumbs up on YouTube. Hit that subscribe, hit that follow button so you can keep getting these episodes in your feed. All right, let's kick into the show. Dana Nielsen, welcome to the show.
Ari, it is a freaking dream to be here, sir. You are a legend.
Oh, man. Oh, gosh. This is, I gotta thank you. And the admiration is reciprocated 100%. But I need to start off by just giving a little insight to the people that didn't experience the last 10 minutes of what we just experienced. The pros and cons of being a Grammy nominated world class mixing and engineering master is that you have very expensive gear and lots of it. Yeah. The downside of it is that to do something as simple as just talk through the computer takes a lot of finagling through your systems, it seems.
It does.
So just to hear your voice. Now you look amazing. Thanks. You sound fantastic.
Thanks.
So your gear is top-notch, clearly, and that board behind you is just stunning.
Well,
and I
want
to get
you.
To all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
but anyway.
Yeah, it's quite
not to get it. Yeah.
Quite an ordeal over here.
So are you at home?
I am. Yeah, this is my home studio.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite a home studio. Well, first off, tell me about this board that you got rocking behind you, because you don't have too many people that have home studios with more than 8 channels, and I'm looking at, how many am I counting?
There's 24.
24, okay.
Yeah. And
what kind of board is that?
It's a DigiDesign with the precursor to Avid, DigiDesign D-Command, which is part of their Icon series of controllers. There's no audio. There is a little audio if you want to use the monitoring section, which I don't. But it is a very, a lot of people these days know about like the S6 or the S3 or some of these newer Avid controllers. And this is the generation before that, which was the Icon series. I guess I've always been with that gear. I've always loved faders. Like I have I sign off all my emails, faders forever. It's kind of a slogan of mine, because I am in the box as a mixer and have been for many years, and which offers incredible flexibility and speed and all that stuff. But man, without tactile.
What do you mix in, Pro Tools?
Yeah, in Pro Tools. Without that tactile control that connects me physically to the faders and allows me to like put different fingers on and feel, you know, oh man, it's like, I think back to the days when I used to do all this with a mouse or trackball in my case, and definitely like have mixed number one albums with a trackball, but it's not.
Oh, wow.
Fun,
okay. Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's
right.
Not,
right. Right.
It really feels special and different and more in tune and connected with faders. So, I've always, because like the S6, I think even like a, for anybody who's listening and doesn't know what that is, it's like the top of the line Avid controller. It's a network device and it's got, you know, even if you get like the 8 fader version, it's going to be like $30,000 or more, you know.
Wow.
And each
and
of
it's
these,
just a controller.
It's just a controller.
Avid, the company that makes Pro Tools. So this is like, I'm imagining a controller just for Pro Tools.
Yeah. And these fancier flagship controllers are some studios will buy them, but more kind of like post-production, a lot of like film broadcast mixing. You go to like a soundstage at, you know, Fox or Warner Brothers or whatever.
Yeah.
The networking capability and remote control and satellite systems, it allows for these insane configurations for, you know, the effects stage and the dialogue and the music and, you know, all these different places to, anyway, it's going a little nerd talk, but What I tend to,
that's fine. Yeah.
You know, what I tend to do is like, as a music engineer and producer, like I need the faders. I want the top of the line stuff. That's like yesterday's used car, you know? So when,
what year did this come out?
Oh gosh.
That predates Avid.
Yeah. This came out when I was, this will be a fun segue, you know, my wife and I moved to LA in 2000 and my first job out of college was, selling this type of equipment, at Guitar Center in Hollywood, Sunset. Right. And I'm a terrible salesperson, but I love the gear and I love like,
cause you buy all the gear yourself.
Yeah. Even when I didn't or don't have money for the things that I want, like I love what it does. And I do love, teaching other people, you know, hearing what their needs are and helping them find the right stuff. So I remember this came out around the early 2000s. Before that, it was the Pro Control, and that's what I had when this came out. And it was the base model, $30,000, you know, controller. I bought the used car of that time, which would have been the Pro Control, which was awesome. And I had that Pro Control for a long, long time. And then when that finally, it didn't break, but they ultimately not only stopped supporting it, but it no longer would work with like the new version of Pro Tools. And at that point, the S6 was out, but it was like, I can't make that leap. That's crazy. So I got this one and it's awesome. I'll do whatever it takes to have faders. And this is awesome because it's 24 faders and I have dedicated knobs for inputs and record enable, solo, mute, panning, sends, and I can at the click of a button, you know, I can create these custom, you know, you take a session that's got, you know, 100+ tracks in it and all these subgroups and fancy routing, and I can navigate around a huge session really quickly and efficiently, and so it becomes even more a navigation and administrative tool for managing large sessions as it does as much fader control and the actual fun stuff, you know.
Oh, nice. So that makes sense. Yeah. So you have a home studio, but you also have a family.
I do.
And you have, you know, what do you do at your home studio? Do you do much tracking? Is it mostly mixing? Are you doing full sessions? Do you have a live room? Like, tell me about this situation you got going on.
Yeah, I've always had a home studio. Even, you know, in college, a little corner of the bedroom. And then through all of our different houses and apartments in LA, always some kind of studio. And I've always done my mixing from home. Even the, you know, earliest, you know, fanciest, you know, big artist stuff has always been from, at sometimes, you know, my first mixes were in like a 6x6, you know, tiny little carpeted bedroom with little speakers and a trackball, you know? It's for, you know, my own writing and producing and then, ultimately mixing. I've never had a dedicated live room. It always is the same spot. And I could probably even like, let me see if this is hooked up. You see a little bit of it.
Oh, wow. Cool. For people just listening, he switched his camera view. That's pretty nifty.
Yeah.
That's a cool contraption.
Yeah. So it's like,
it looks great.
There's a bunch of, it's a big room. It's like a 20x20 room. And so
do you bring clients in to listen to mixing process? Right. I see the couch there and everything. Yeah. That's nice.
I would say, to break it down, like all of my tracking I tend to do elsewhere. If it's like a full band, drums, I never do drums here and stuff, but I definitely do a lot of, pre-production, definitely a lot of writing, singer-songwriter stuff. If it's somebody, you know, acoustic guitar and vocal, I do a lot of that, that type of stuff here. A lot of overdubs, a lot of vocals, even though there isn't a vocal ISO, except for like, you can kind of see behind me here, my little makeshift booth. It doesn't close off, but
yeah. Is that a, I see that. Yeah.
But it's a, it's a popper enough
stopper in front of the mic.
Yeah. It's, it does the trick. It's not ideal. I love to be somewhere else where I can be in a controlled listening environment, not on headphones for vocals and stuff like that. But, I definitely do a ton of vocals here.
Is this where you mixed SOS, SZA's record, or the few songs that you did on SZA's record?
Yep. Yeah, I literally mix everything I've ever mixed
Right here in the house. Well, that's right, because, so you moved, is this the first place you moved when you moved to LA in 2000? Have you been living here for 24 years?
No, we have been living here for 24 years, but not in this house. We had a couple of apartments in Glendale and then a house in Glendale. I also had that was the one time I had a studio away from home with my buddy McKay Garner. Shout out to him. Amazing engineer. and so I shared a little spot in his studio for a while. And then we moved to the West Side, Santa Monica, which is where I had the tiny, we had a tiny beach house type of thing, you know, several blocks from the beach. But you get the idea that it was like a very small home. pre-kid. And then when we knew that we were going to outgrow that family, that house, and wanted to start a family, we moved to this house in Culver West, or Mar Vista. It's kind of a little overlap area. And a lot more space. And it's just been awesome. We love it here. And this room in particular has been great. It's all kitted out acoustically. And Carissa, my wife, who is a session singer, vocal contractor, music therapist, she now has her own studio, Studio C for Carissa. Hers is built in the backyard, which I can see out through the windows here.
Oh, wow. So, oh, that's awesome. Have you ever wired from there to there, from the back house to your room here
set
and tracked
up
live?
We have Dante run underground that comes into here.
What's Dante run?
Oh, Dante is that's like the Ethernet audio protocol.
Cool.
You can do like a zillion channels over Ethernet, like one cool cable.
Nice.
And it's used more and more in studios, definitely in live and stuff like that. It's pretty wild. So when we were running, you know, internet cables and stuff out there, I was like, "Ooh, let's toss a couple, you know, Dante lines in there," which basically just means some extra like Cat 6 cables. So we're set up for that, but haven't done it yet.
Nice. So how'd you get your start? You know, your credits list by this point is unfathomable. You've worked with every legend from Bob Dylan to SZA and Rick Rubin and Chili Peppers and Metallica and on and on and on, Neil Diamond. But everybody starts somewhere. Mm-hmm. And a kid from Chicago, how does he get to go on to create all these incredible records? And just give me a little bit of your journey and just kind of how this all came to be.
Yeah. Well, it all from Chicago. I mean, what got my foot in the door is I bring a Giordano's pizza to every studio in town. I say, I'll trade you a slice for a internship.
A slice, a deep dish.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And we Carissa and I both grew up in Chicago suburbs and then went to school in New Orleans at Loyola. We moved here right after college. And, like I say, I had my home studio and was just kind of, I would run an ad every month in Music Connection. And, and I would get like cool, you know, independent clients, you know, some like working at the, the Sunset Guitar Center by day and doing producing and writing artists out of our house and apartment by night. And eventually, through a series of jobs, first it was Guitar Center. Outside sales was like this, what's not now formalized as Guitar Center Pro, but back then was the upstairs, like off off the floor area of the Hollywood Guitar Center. And this woman, Susan Wheeler there, she had all these amazing clients that are people who wouldn't necessarily come into the store and poke around in the cacophony that that is a Guitar Center. And because I was very lucky timing-wise to have been in the, I was a jazz major at Loyola, who fell in love with the recording studio there.
What was your instrument?
Saxophone. Nice. And I... The studio at Loyola happened to have recently, at that time, had upgraded to what was like, unbeknownst to me, the state-of-the-art 24-bit 888s. You know, if you're a Pro Tools head, you'd be like, oh man, that's, I remember that gear. It was like really, really baller for the time. And it's just what I cut my teeth on. And I did a ton of my own projects in there. I was the TA. I had a set of keys. I would stay in there literally all night. And, you know, I remember many times my, the music, the director of the music program, his office was right outside the studio, and he'd see me in the morning and be like, "You been here all night again, Dana?" You know, like, yeah. So we moved to LA, and I didn't realize it at the time how special it was at that time to know, for a young, employable, you know, nobody like me to have this like Pro Tools experience. I was also at that time already like a beta tester for DigiDesign. And so Susan at the Guitar Center, she was like, you should come up and work with me and my clients. Because again, I was like the not star salesman, but very knowledgeable, helpful person, you know. And so she would do the selling to these incredible clients, and then she'd send me to go set them up and train them. I went to David Foster's compound several times, and I'd go to like, you know, Ocean Way and drop things off. Or I remember that was actually the first time I ever went to the Houdini Mansion, Rick Rubin's famed studio in Laurel Canyon, for the first time. Wow. probably years before I met and started working with Rick. But I met a lot of people that way. And when I left Guitar Center and later started doing the same type of job a couple of years later, freelance this time for Westlake, also in Hollywood, which is extra fun and cool because that's a like historic recording studio where a lot of incredible records were made and continue to be made. So, you know, maybe it was 2002 or something like that. I was doing a similar type of thing for their sales department while mingling in the studio department. And the short of it is like same type of thing. They would sell to these unreal, you know, I'd go to Diane Warren's place and, you know, that's how I met, Colin Hay from Men at Work, who I had a long history with both professionally and as a dear friend. John Hanlon, nice. Who's Neil Young's longtime co-producer. So if you look at my discography and you can see like all these years later, like, oh, these are some of the same folks. And to make a long story slightly shorter, that's kind of how it started to happen. You know, I would help these incredible producers and engineers who at the time Pro Tools was like brand new to folks who were working on tape or Sony digital machines or, and so it was this new thing. And that's what I mean about the timing. It just happened to work out that I knew this stuff. To Guitar Center's credit, they sent me up to Palo Alto for a week or two. And like I would get like special training from reps. Like I was their product specialist, you know? So, yeah. Eventually, like I just had all these incredible clients, and, I'll tell you a story. This is important in my development that I think a lot of people would, appreciate is, one of these folks, I was, tasked by one of these companies on a sales call to support a sale, go to like, I think it was Fox or Warner Brothers mm-hmm. on the lot. And I brought this like, you know, I'm drooling over these boxes that I'm bringing in to this guy. I don't even know. I can't remember who this person was, but he's an important part in my history where I brought in this, you know, $50,000 Pro Tools rig into this little bungalow on the lot. And I'm like, wow, this is insane. Look at this place. And like, I have chills thinking about it. Like, who is this guy who gets to play with this gear that I love in this awesome little studio bungalow in between these sound stages? And so we're chit-chatting and I'm putting it all together physically and inserting cards and installing software and just kind of, you know, shooting the breeze. And when we wrapped up, you know, we kind of had this rapport and he's like, so what is it you want to do? You know? And I was like, aghast. I couldn't understand that he didn't read on my face like that. And I was like, I want to do what you're doing. I want to use this equipment and like have a job, you know, like work in music and be a, and he was like, really? You know, he had no idea. And he said, you know, man, you got to tell people what it is you want, you know? And I was like, man, I thought you could just read it on me. Like it was oozing out of me, you know? And that was a really important lesson. He's like, yeah, man, just let people know like what you want. And that really has helped me get like all the gigs.
Wow.
There's so many stories in my career path that are based on that guy's advice, you know, where you see an opportunity and maybe you're overhearing, you know, give you another example where overhearing, like I was working with Dave Schiffman on System of a Down. And at this point I've been second engineering, assistant engineering stuff at Rick Rubin's studio at his home. And I could hear Dave trying to, I think he was talking to Andrew Sheps, and who I hadn't met at that point, and needed somebody to edit these vocals and drums and stuff on this project. And he wasn't, I could tell by this conversation I'm overhearing that Andrew wasn't available. And I said,
and Andrew Sheps was the producer of the record.
No, Rick was producing.
Working on, or he was the mix. Rick was producing. He was the mixing engineer.
Dave Shipman was the engineer on the Hypnotize and Mesmerize albums.
Got it.
And I was assisting Dave, and but I saw this opportunity, you know, and very, you know, humbly, gently. it's always this fine line between, you know, being persistent and being annoying, you know, but like, hey man, like, I would love an opportunity to do what it is you need. I've done that work in the past. I know how to, you know, edit vocals and stuff like that. You know, and he's like, I don't know. You know?
Right.
And through a process of like, you know, flying this idea around, and that was a really big break for me. And Andrew, I don't know if you know these names, but these two, these are both legendary, amazing engineers who were both mentors to me and from whom I learned a ton. And Andrew came down and, you know, he's like, I can't do this gig, but I'll show you, you know, he showed me Melodyne that day, and I hadn't used that before. And then I ended up doing that on those, it's a double album, and used Melodyne.
System of a Down used Melodyne. Let it be known, and gentlemen.
You know, at the time, it wasn't.
Everyone was using Melodyne at the time, yeah, right?
But
this
also,
is what, 2008,
9?
Later?
Or I feel like earlier. Maybe 7 or 8. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
I got a plaque in my closet I could go look at. but it was at that point, you know, it wasn't a plugin, and it was a mm-hmm. lot of, and what I still do to this day with Melodyne is as much timing as tuning. You know, there's like,
oh yeah,
a
sure.
lot of stacks of things and massaging them together and maintaining mm-hmm. what's amazing about an artist's delivery and the delivery mm-hmm. that makes them unique, preserving that and just knowing how much to massage where needed to make it jive with somebody else who overdubbed on top of it or whatever.
Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder. And yeah, they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative. And they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and you get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register with Sound Exchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue, they have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out Too Lost. You can just go to toolost.com. Use the promo code Ari's Take for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think.
So, yeah,
sure, that makes sense. It's a tool, and it's not as much of a dirty word as like auto-tune or what it used to be. But Melodyne is something I think everyone is very friendly with in the studio and can be so powerful. And like you said, if the take is perfect and the delivery and the performance is magic, but they're just like just slightly off pitch, like not quite there nailing it, it's just like why try to get that perfect magical take again only for the pitch when we have this incredible tool that can just like ever so slightly massage it to where it can be. So that makes a lot of
sense. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. It really is an amazing, amazing tool.
You know, you were in the room, and it's really like you got that opportunity. You know, they say luck is merely when preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you had been prepared. You knew you could do it, and the opportunity presented itself. But you also raised your hand. You put yourself out there, and that's like I think a really good takeaway. Like you said, from your friend from the lot.
Yeah. The unknown, unnamed guy.
Who, the unknown, right. Do we still not know who this guy is?
No, but...
Okay, I was going to say, like, I was waiting for it to turn out, and it was Rick Rubin. No, no it wasn't. Okay. I'm still waiting for, like, who was that guy?
He's
like
the mystery man in my, you know, career past, who I'm thankful for.
But it's so true. And LA especially, which is a town of hustlers and a town of freelancers, and it's kind of everyone is on short-term contracts. Everyone is jumping from job to job in the entertainment industry. Yeah. You know, even if you feel like you're in something as secure as like television, which is not secure at all, it's because everyone's doing short-term. You work on a TV show, and then the show ends, and now you got to find something else, or you're doing, you know, scoring for this or whatever. But in music also, especially, of course, even quicker turnaround. Yeah. You do a track, a song, even an album, that's going to end. And so everyone, just by putting yourself out there and just saying what you're looking for, what you want, I mean, that is, but for me at least, I've been here 14 years, has been the best way to just find the right people, find opportunities, and put yourself in that position, because everyone is always looking for something or always needing something. Yeah. And it's just, it's like it on a cold way, you could say it's very transactional. LA can feel very transactional. You can kind of, there's a bit of humanity that's lost in these types of relationships and these types of interactions, I should say. But at the same time, you know, that's how the business works. But you can also develop those deeper relationships. It just takes a bit more effort to, versus another profession where it's a full-time job in an office for years on end. Right. You're developing these deeper relationships. You kind of have to go out of your way to develop those relationships. And so, that's great. I want to know how you met Rick Rubin. You said you're a longtime collaborator with him, and you said you were in that room because of him. How did that happen?
Well, that's another wild story. That the connection was one of those, John Hanlon, who, like I had mentioned earlier, is one of the folks who, as a, you know, young 22 or 3-year-old or something, I went out to his place in Malibu to install a Pro Tools system, you know, when I was working for for my business, but freelancing for Westlake's sales.
John
division.
Hanlon, the producer, engineer, mixing engineer, Neil Young, Stephen Stills, Beach Boys, REM, T-Bone Burnett. Right.
And so in this same vein as what we're talking about, of making, you know, making things known, what you want to do. I had been going out to him. I set him up on, you know, him paying Westlake, I think, as part of like an extended, you know, sales bundle, you know, or something like that. You know, he bought, this is a guy who, I love John. He you know, lives and breathes tape. And so he was, you know, one of these folks in the early 2000s who was interested in Pro Tools and digital audio, and kind of dipped a toe in, and excited, as we all were and are, that like, wow, we can, without a tape machine, you know, I can set up a little thing on my dining room table and make a recording. And so I initially set him up, and then he had me out another time to do some more training. And by this point we've hit it off, and I'm fascinated by his career and like, my goodness, how do you do this? And he was very giving with, you know, some techniques for mic techniques and stuff that I was interested in, and just had these amazing experiences. And at one point he suggested, he's like, you know, can I keep booking time with you or giving you a call here and there when I get stuck on something? And maybe can we do sort of like a little barter? You know, I'll teach you the old school stuff if you'll teach me the new school stuff, you know? And I was like, sure. Mm-hmm. And so we went on like that off, you know, sporadically for years. And true to his word, you know, I remember he would send me like, I remember one time, you know, he would tell me about, he taught me the like Glyn Johns drum miking technique initially. And he taught me different acoustic guitar miking techniques that I still use. And he would send me like printouts of the attack and release times of a Fairchild. You know, a Fairchild is a super fancy compressor, very coveted compressor, and it works instead of attack and release. There's like these time constants, and they're just fixed numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know. And that stuff blew my mind. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is some secret knowledge about the most expensive, you know, compressor in the world, whatever. And you know, I would reciprocate. I'd get lots of super frustrated calls, you know, and he'd be like, you know, Pro Tools is the stupidest thing in the world. How can I do it? Right. I'd be like, it's okay. Here, let me help you out. And then he would always call, you know, 20 minutes later and be like, it's amazing. Oh my gosh. And so, the way Rick gets involved in this is years later, John was working on a project for Rick, recording a live, Jayhawks album. And, I knew about this 'cause we talked at one point when he was on the road and I was like, oh, that's so cool. You know, like, and you're working with Rick Rubin, how neat, you know, I'd love to come help you out. And I was always, again, like the mystery man, instructed me, on the film lot, you know,
gotta say what you want.
Can I please come like be an actual like assistant for you at some point, you know? Yeah. Oh, we will, you know, he would say, we'll do that, you know, but this one, you know, it's with Rick and it's at Rick's, I'm going to be home in a week and I'm going to be mixing at Rick's home studio. And it's not something I can like, you know, invite you over to or get you involved in. Oh, that's all right, man. Keep me in mind. And then a few weeks later, you know, I was doing a gig at my studio in Atwater. And I remember it was kind of like a downtrodden day. I was really getting grinded, you know, by some, artist I was working with and I'm like, okay, another take. Sure, man. You know, and John called and because I was in a session, I didn't pick it up and I listened to the voicemail and he was like, Dana, I'm back. I'm working at Rick's and, you know, Rick's, assistant and Pro Tools operator had to leave, for a family, like a family emergency or something. And I thought I could do this on my own and I just can't. And like, would you please find it in your heart to come up here for a few days and help me out? And I'm sure it's not what you're used to getting paid. Like it was this very, you know, hopeful message. And the whole time I'm just like, you know, like, how much do I pay you? Like, how does this work?
Right.
And I was so excited and it was freaking magical. You know, I'll never forget.
Yeah.
First time.
Was this at Shangri-La?
No, this was long before, Shangri-La. Okay. This was, at a
the Houdini house you were saying?
It's near there. It was, Rick had a place, this really gorgeous, you know, place above the Sunset Strip. And, you know, kind of La Cienega area, up the hill and just incredible view and this beautiful, Neve, 8068, console. And it's like, it's where he lived, but the studio was down below with this lookout over the, just awesome. And,
so cool.
And so there was John and, so much analog gear going on, console, tape machines. And so there was no automation. And, so I was doing Pro Tools playback and minor edits while he was mixing to like a quarter inch or half inch Studer. And, and you know, one of the best parts was he was like, you know, all right, I can't reach all these things. And there's a harmonica solo coming up on this song. You know, I'm going to be riding the vocals and guitar. Like you grab the harmonica fader down there or whatever. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. You know?
Nice.
So anyway, that session went awesome. And I met Rick and I met, his, production coordinator, this wonderful woman, Lindsay at the time. And Lindsay wanted to keep me busy with some like, you know, tape cataloging, you know, in that studio, there were these 2-inch reels of the most legendary albums. Like you just see them like on a bookshelf or something and mind blowing, albums that I, you know, grew up with.
I can imagine. And, yeah. Right. I can only imagine what you'd be seeing there.
And so at the time, you know, she had, this is a long story, but it's an interesting one. And it's almost to the end. And it's worth telling where She said, you know, Dana,
I'm into it.
Would you be around to like come back and maybe catalog some of these tapes? We have these, you know, tapes that need, I'm like, hey, anything. I'm so down. Okay. Well,
yeah,
I'm really busy right now. Things are nuts, but give me a call in a few weeks, you know? And so I called in a few weeks. Oh yeah, Dana. Right. I'm too busy. I can't think about that right now. Haven't forgotten about you. Give me a call back in 2 weeks, you know? And mm-hmm, I probably mm-hmm. did that like, you know, 4 times or so. And it was always the same response. And, mm-hmm. and so I just kind of was like, damn, I don't think this is a dead end. You know, I don't want to keep bothering mm-hmm, this poor woman.
Sure.
And I happened to talk to, a friend from Loyola who had moved to LA for a while as well. And mm-hmm. I remember around the same time, like I remember before I met Rick and Lindsay, he had been doing some work with Rick at that house with Lindsay. And so, and when we caught up for a moment, we had, his name is Dave, and we hadn't talked in a while. And I was explaining, you know, he said, hey, weren't you going to do some stuff? I said, yeah, but I'm kind of getting this run around. It seemed like a really amazing opportunity, but every time I call and Lindsay, you know, mentioned that, and he was like, dude, no, she's not messing with you. Like she is so mm-hmm. busy. That's not her blowing you off. You got to call back and keep yourself fresh in mind. You know, I was like, all right. And I did. And it had been months at this point, and it took a moment for her to remember, you know, who I was and oh yeah, Dana. Right. You were assisting, John Hanlon, you know? And I was like, yeah, you had mentioned cataloging these tapes. And she's like, yeah, forget about all that. Do you do second engineering as well? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think John was the only person I'd second engineered for at that point. But of course, uh-huh. yeah.
Always say yes.
Always say yes.
Yes to everything. Yeah. You'll figure it out later. Yeah. Right.
So she said, okay, well, I'm going to add you to my list of second engineers and keep mm-hmm. you in mind. And I was like, okay, wow, great. So thank you to Dave again for like giving that extra push. Like you got to call her back. And she probably, I think she called like a day or two later and was like, are you available to second engineer for Greg Fiddleman? We're starting a new Neil Diamond project at Neil's studio and Rick's producing.
Cool.
And I was just like, what is happening? Like, yes, I will be there. And
that was Home Before Dark?
No, that was 12 songs.
And
the album before that, and which was incredible. Yeah. And ever since then, it was just for, I don't know, 15 years or so, it was just nonstop amazing stuff.
I mean, you have great energy, and Rick is always, he's all about the energy, mm-hmm. From what I gather. Mm-hmm. I've never worked with him, but I'm a fan and admirer, and you know, I'm reading his book right now. But it's so much about the vibe and the energy, and I'm sure that, like, you know, had you been in that room that day and you weren't giving off the energy that gelled with what he was orchestrating and creating in the room, you wouldn't have gotten another call.
That's very true.
It's, again, the preparation meets opportunity, that you kind of knew how to handle yourself in a room like that. But also, I mean, just kind of who you are and how you carry yourself. I mean, I think that's, you know, a big testament to that as well.
Yeah. You know, to your point, I remember when I was starting out and I mentioned to Lindsay, again, you know, Rick's production coordinator, who really, you know, schedules and, you know, plans and studio dates and held mm-hmm. all this stff together. And there was an amazing crew of non-engineers who worked at Rick's house mm-hmm. as part of the, you know, Lindsay's staff or Rick's staff and they were all so awesome. Like really magnificent people I'm still friends with to this day. And I remember telling Lindsay, you know, maybe the first week or two that I was really kicking around there a lot. man, Lindsay, I said, everybody here is just so nice and so cool. It's just amazing. And she said, like very matter-of-factly, she said, yeah, they wouldn't be here if they weren't, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, of course. Like you can, right. You know, of course you have the coolest people. Like, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course.
You know, and it's like, you're right. I mean, it is very much, especially in the studio, not to mention outside of the studio and personal space of the house or whatever. Rick is very, very in tune to the energy and the vibe and making a space for the artist to feel free and open and creative and unencumbered and you know, nothing encumbers an artist and a vibe in the studio than somebody who's like, oh, I'm talking too much, or I'm a real loud talker, and I'm like, I chew with my mouth open, and I'm I smell, and I'm a pain in the butt, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's some basic essentials that go a long way.
Yeah. So, you know, this is the New Music Business podcast, and I would be remiss to not talk to you about the business of all of this, of everything behind it. My first question, though, is if you could help us understand all these various roles in a major studio recording project, like you mentioned second engineer. For someone who only does independent recordings, you know, shoestring budgets, all of that, what is a second engineer? And just kind of lay out all the roles, you know, because I looked at your credits and man, I don't even know. Some things you're just listening to studio personnel and I don't even know what that means. What are you just hanging around for the vibes? No.
That's a vague one that you probably will see that on like... you know, title or something, or if they don't have a, usually the studio personnel I find on title or, you know, other credits places is kind of, you're there in addition to your other credit. Like if you find one where it says I'm studio personnel, I probably also have a named credit elsewhere, but they seem to have this duplicate studio personnel credit that you'll show.
Well, lay out some of what these credits that you've had or some of the ones in the studio and just what they do. Let's start because you mentioned it. What is a second engineer?
Well, a second engineer is these days, you don't hear it too often. And it's a little vague. And I think for all intents and purposes, it's kind of like an assistant engineer. Another word that you'll hear is house engineer, which is an engineer that is on staff at a studio and can assist your sessions if you're not bringing your own assistant or something like that. A second engineer might be a nicer, well, a perfect example would be like me helping out on a fader move or something like that, you know, where, you know, where there's a main engineer, it's that person's, you know, project, but there are times when you need someone additional. That's another name you might hear, like additional engineer. And all of those in practical purposes kind of are the same, are different names for sort of the same thing. It's like an engineer, someone who's involved in the engineering side of a project who isn't the lead engineer, you know, and you might see multiple lead engineers on a project. And that would mean that, you know, this person was a lead engineer for a while and then this person became it, or this person did all of the band tracking and then this person ended up doing the vocal tracking or something. Maybe the artist's engineer did some stuff. So it's not uncommon to have, even though I'm saying the words like main engineer, there are oftentimes multiple main engineers. But as a sort of way to separate kind of experience and ranking and credit and, you know, hierarchy, rather than putting everybody in the studio on that line, there is kind of a sort of ladder. And it's very confusing, man. I mean, that ladder, whether you're assistant, or second or additional or whatever that word is going to be, or if you're an editor, sure. if you're a mixer, you know, my experience, like, you know, I mentioned that Neil Diamond, 12 Songs, that was the first album I worked on with Rick. And that was Greg Fiddleman Engineering, who I adore. Greg and I have done tons and tons of albums together, and I've learned so much from him. There was a, I ended up doing my first like big mixing job was like on that same album. There's an artist cut. Greg mixed that full album.
Okay.
But speaking of, you know, music business, that album was released like the year that, you remember those like anti-piracy stickers and that on CDs that came around? Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was a new campaign to stop piracy, and it there was a real backlash. I think it was a Sony thing that screwed up a handful of releases when this first was rolled out. Like, you couldn't play it in computers or
oh, that's right. Remember that. And so they wouldn't even play in some like cars, stereos or computers. Yeah, right, exactly.
Uh-huh. Anyway, it was around that time, right. And we did a second version of the album that was like stripped down, you know, kind of like a Let It Be Naked or something, you know, with just the original components, no overdubs. And that was an amazing break for me. I was doing rough mixes, editing and rough mixes to present to Rick, and he loved the roughs. And I knew this was going to be my first time like playing my like
a mix.
And so of course I like really worked on that stuff, and it was so cool. You know, he called Neil and was like, I think we found our guy, and I was just and you know, so I was very early on in my career, especially with Rick at that point. And the point of that story is not just that it was a really amazing moment and project for me, but that after that, you know, I moved around a lot. You know, now I'm back to being an assistant again, and now I'm editing again. Mm-hmm. And when am I going to get to mix again? You know, you know, like you said about LA and how it's gig to gig, man, it's, you know what I'm talking about. It's just, it is like that. It's all short term, and you can be flying high 1 minute and then not the next, you know, or,
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the business. So there's all these different roles. I mean, when you get offered a job for whatever position it may be, whether it's that assistant engineer, an editor, mixing engineer, lay out, like, give me some figures. Tell me how this works. Who, like, what are you, like, what could someone expect? If someone who, like, doesn't know the business at all, is not in LA, but wants to break in as an engineer, as, you know, maybe starting as an assistant, something, just wants to start working on records like this. Just help me understand what the business model looks like. What do assistant engineers make? What do mixing engineers make? What do lead engineers make? What do, you know, like I think there's a lot of understanding like producers and stuff like that, but not enough is discussed around engineers. I honestly have no concept or even a ballpark of what engineers at this level make. I know what I pay my mixing engineers and engineers, but that's like a shoestring indie self-released whatever. Like on these like major records, when you're working with some of the biggest artists in the world, some of the biggest producers in the world on major labels, tell me about the business.
It's usually, there's a couple different scenarios. The regular path is, which I didn't really do, is you work through a studio. Like let's say you go to East West or something, or and you say, you try to get a job. First, it's like you're an intern, and that's probably unpaid, but you're running around, you know, emptying garbage and making coffee maybe, or and you're also getting vetted, you know, you're like, those are hard gigs to get because you're around, you know, important people and certainly right. expensive equipment. And so even though it's not paid, it is still can be very competitive. And I hope I'm not doing a disservice to this hierarchy, which I didn't really do, but I'm very well aware of. Usually you come in as an intern. If you are well-liked and do great work, the next thing you might be a runner. And a runner is paid probably minimum wage to go get stuff, office supplies, food orders, errands, wash the artist's car, whatever's needed. A big studio will have a staff of people who can accommodate needs like that. So people will spend a long time in a runner position, hoping that one day they can take the place of one of the house engineers or would also be known as an assistant engineer oftentimes. Runners are also, it's a great gig because while they're not typically allowed in a session, like in the control room or live room, while the artist is there, they're very useful for teardown and setup. And at the end of every night too, so when the session is over and the artist has gone, I see this a lot when the artist is gone, the producer has left. And if I'm the engineer, I still have lots of work to do. I'm going to be making rough mixes. I'm going to be comping things. But as soon as the artist and producer leave, the doors open, runners come in, the house engineer is explaining what needs to get done. Maybe there's a changeover. We're switching from, rhythm section to overdub. So there's going to be a lot of moving parts in the studio, recalling the console. So even when you're a runner, you do get to hang out in the studio and be helpful and start learning the ropes. And then you try to get one of the jobs as a house engineer. And that'll mean,
what does that pay?
I don't know, honestly.
Well, you were an assistant engineer, a second engineer. What does that pay?
Back when I was the engineering stuff, I don't know about a house engineer. That's probably more salaried thing,
More salary. Yeah.
All of my work has been freelance. And in the engineering world, it's usually billed as a day rate. Certainly, as you get more established, that's pretty much the norm is a day rate, or it could be hourly.
What's a ballpark of a day rate for a second engineer for these big records?
Let's see. Like my guy, I've been paying. He's like 50 an hour. If I hire an assistant for stuff or an engineer, I'm on a shoestring as well,
No, I mean for the major label records, not for, the ones that you're going out of pocket or something for an indie record.
But it's still, for an assistant, I don't remember. I remember as an editor on big projects, back then, I think I was billing like 800 a day or something like that, to sit in a room, and comp vocals and comp band stuff. And,
I was going to say, what does an editor do? Because, as someone who's only worked, with usually one or two people in a studio at a time, on the technical staff where it's like, the producer and the engineer, which is like very, very typical for kind of what I've done. It's like the engineer is doing everything. Yeah. They're the first, second, third, fourth engineer. They're the editor. They're doing Pro Tools. Whatever. But so what does an editor do if you're just an editor?
It's kind of a thing that I ended up doing a lot of, for more, experienced engineers. At the time, these would be like, Greg Fiddleman and Andrew Sheps and Dave Schiffman and, my buddy Ryan Hewitt, where these are projects that are massive and high profile and moving fast, like faster than the editing work can keep up, the comping, the tuning, the aligning, the that stuff. And so it's kind of this great little, at least for me, I found for many years, a great little in between being an assistant or, you know, a second engineer and being the lead engineer. I would oftentimes come in once the pile of editing work was so great that more hands on deck were needed, or I'd be along. Another thing that I would do a lot is be Pro Tools operator. And that's another like,
what does that mean? Isn't everything run through Pro Tools these days?
Most projects. Yeah. There are some that are, you know, when I work, well, even when I do the Neil Young stuff with John Hanlon, that's still tape, but we're also running everything into Pro Tools 192K. And
just so I understand, is Pro Tools a catch-all term, or you literally mean the Avid program Pro Tools, and you don't work in Logic or Ableton or any of these other DAWs, FL Studio, or anything out there that are professional DAWs out there?
It's literal. In the same sense,
literal approaches. Yeah. Okay.
In the same sense that, like, the older term tape op would be somebody who knows tape machines inside and out and can throw reels on and off that thing super fast and can calibrate them, keep them clean. It's a similar job being a Pro Tools op.
Have you worked in other DAWs?
Me? Not like on a big record like that. I use, I love Ableton as well. I do stuff in Machine, which is kind of has its own DAW. I feel like, you know, my take on the other softwares is when you're a songwriter or producer, the sky's the limit. Like you can use any of these platforms because you're your own kind of creative being. You're like the one-stop shop. It's your canvas to whatever you feel comfortable in. But in the world of recording studios and being of service to other people and their music, Pro Tools is pretty still the standard. If you want to be a freelance engineer or mixer or something like that. So, you know, and that's not a diss on any of the other wonderful, powerful, you know, DAWs that are out there. It just seems to be what most, where sessions end up. So if you have a songwriter or producer who works in Logic, tons of people work in Logic or Ableton or whatever.
Sure.
When it comes time to overdub a bunch of vocals with somebody else at a major studio, let's say you made this awesome track and, you know, now... you know, now we're going to the studio because Rihanna's going to go on it or something like that. Excuse me. Chances are all of those Logic tracks are going to get brought into Pro Tools and, you know, her vocal producer is going to probably, I'm making assumptions here, but this is kind of what I mean is that things will end up as it turns from a track making creative process to more of a technical recording process and mixing process. Things kind of make their way into Pro Tools.
That makes sense. And I would imagine that probably happened on the Scissor record just because, you know, a lot of, and what I found fascinating about that album is it's such a dynamic record in the sense it's so diverse in terms of the production style. You have stuff that sounds like, you know, a more traditional R&B, you know, sound that was production that was created in the box, like a beat, like what we would call a beat, you know, the colloquial term of beat, which really just, you know, the instrumental production that was, you know, probably created in Logic or Ableton or something like that. I don't know. And then there are some tracks like the one that one of the ones that you mixed F2F that was more of like a full band sound, yeah. But then there's a combination of both. Yeah. And so I would imagine that it went through that similar process.
Yeah. And a lot of stuff, you know, I'm pretty sure that most of that stuff was done in Pro Tools. There were Pro Tools sessions mm-hmm. that were sent to me, and I got that gig through my friend Rob Beisel, who's amazing and was mm-hmm. one time assistant of mine, a very talented dude. Wow, we've worked cool. on tons of albums together, and he, you know, he moved to LA, and we had a meeting out in my back patio, and he, you know, just has had this incredible trajectory, and I'm so proud of him. And so I know he's a Pro Tools guy.
He was the producer on Kill Bill yeah. on the album, and a few others who co-produced Blind.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. So I mean, I bring Gone that up girl. Both as a cool rags to riches story. Not that he was from mm-hmm, rags, mm-hmm. you know, but also as sure. like, I, you know, I happen to know, he uses Ableton as well, but, I'm sure you're right. Yeah. You know, there were lots of different producers on there, and that is very common to a lot of DAWs are in the creative process and then Pro Tools for the technical
right. Yeah.
Process.
I haven't heard of too many producers that use Pro Tools for beat making creation for like I just don't know. I'm not really in the technical world as well yeah. or in the production world as much. It just seems that more in the hip hop, R&B, pop realm make their beats somewhere else, and then when it comes to actually tracking organic instruments or vocals or something, that's when you kind of transfer on over mm-hmm. to Pro Tools yeah. or something. But so tell me more. I want to get back to kind of the business side of all of this. Tell me more about, so we're saying like an editor is like maybe 800 a day or something like that. What are some of these other technical roles in a studio and how that works? And I mean, even like, well, let's do mixing engineer, because that's a very visible, and very important, arguably one of the most important technical aspects of a record. How is that working? What are the ballpark ranges that a mixing engineer can expect on some of these big major label records?
Yeah, that too is like all over the map and very, you know, none of this stuff is unionized. There's no set rates. It's definitely a very freelance and supply and demand and name recognition type sure. of thing. and honestly, you know, a lot of my stuff for the major stuff is like, it goes all over the place, but oftentimes it'll be like $3,500 or something like that per song. And that'll include
per song.
Revisions wow. and stems and, you know, the whole nine yards. Because that is, and it can be the gamut. I mean, I've done mixes for mm-hmm. $500 and I've done mixes, sure. you know, for more. And I certainly know other high profile mixers that, you know, get many, many, many thousands more, you know, if you really have like some sort of superstar mixer name. And you also, mm-hmm. you know, I don't have points on everything I do, but a lot of stuff, you know, so there's another, you know, there's a way once you have done enough or, maybe you're involved enough in a project, where you can, that, and the artist, agrees that you can participate in some, you know, net receipts, royalties if the album were to recoup.
The mixing engineer can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are we looking, what are we talking about in terms of
for
points?
Mixers, you know, for mixers, it's typical, like a 1 point type of thing.
And you said net receipts. Can you just explain what that means on a record,
yeah.
you know, like on a major label record? And does that come from the artist share or how does that all work?
Yeah. So just okay. like producer points, any, usually the record contract stipulates, you know, that any third party royalty people is going to come out of the artist's share. And that's how producers get points. Those come out of, you know, so if you look at the, you know, traditional, let's say 85-15 split from where a major label is taking 85% of the master, or paying out a fifth, they're taking all the master and paying the artist a 15% royalty. The net receipts part works for the artist as well, where if the label has, you know, spent X amount of dollars to make the recording, paying studio time and all associated recording costs, they're going to make all of that back before anyone gets a royalty, the artist included. So that's the net part. The receipts, I think, just kind of alluding to the receipts of the cost to make the thing. So once the album has been recouped, which is, that's a whole other discussion because, you know, the more you spend on an album, the harder it can be to recoup. Most albums don't recoup. But it's still, I think, an important formality and precedent. Something that I always will ask for, knowing that the majority, it's not going to mean anything financially, but it's sort of a representation of the creative part that that I can bring to the project, the personal creative IP, if you will, apart from the song and all that, that is imbued in the master by way of creative decisions from the mixer's perspective. And so, yeah, those points, let's say the artist has a deal with the producer and they're giving the producer 3 points and a mixer 1 point or 5 and 1 or superstar mixer getting 3, you know, 2, well, like whatever it is, that's going to be from their slice of 15. And so that's something that is, takes a while to get your head around too, is like 1 point doesn't mean 1% of the master share. It means 1/15th of the artist share, or whatever the artist's share is. And it's tricky. It's hard to stipulate a bit in contractual terms because you don't always know what the artist's deal is. And so you have to use, you know, special language that's like, you know, will be paid in the same accordance as other contributors and artists. So it's like, it's this real nebulous scale. And oftentimes I don't know what percentage that 1 point is until I see it in SoundExchange, you know, and I'll see, oh, there's an, okay, so I'm getting, you know, 5% or something like that. Okay, so that means that if 1 point's 5%, then I can kind of figure out what the artist's deal was or something like that.
Right, because you would do like 1 divided by, I'm like crunching it right now, 1 divided by 18, that's, you're looking at around 5.5% or something like that. So you're like, oh, okay, the artist is probably getting 18 percent on, you know, in their deal, or like what's 1 divided by 17 is like,
that's it. And so, lot, what I end up doing, and, you know, of course I have lawyer and boilerplate stuff, but for that I've created with them for my own agreements, I like to just talk in the percentage. And I think I've talked on Ari's Take Academy in comments about that as well, where it's much easier to, you know, the points lingo is very old school. And the recording agreements these days are all over the map. And in a great way. And so many artists own their masters and release things entirely. So rather than using the older lingo, you know, for points based on a, you know, 15 point artist deal or 18 or 20 or whatever, it's just easier to say, you know, I'd like 5% of the artist share, you know, and if you own 100% of that master, that's 5% of 100. And, you know, if you, if you have 15%, it's, you know, 5% of that 15. So it's scalable and people tend to understand it more as well. It's a little easier.
Yeah. And that in producer deals, that's very similar too. They say, you know, typically you're getting between 15 to 25% of the artist share. Yeah. And for indie records, you know, producers that I've seen and worked with, that, you know, it'll be around that range. And when you're crunching those numbers, like, of like, okay,
3 points.
Typically a producer's getting 3 points, you know, divided by 15, that's 20% right there. So exactly. So that makes a lot of sense. Dana, time has flown by, and I could keep talking to you for the next four
Likewise,
hours.
Man.
And I wish we could. I know it's been a treat to understand this side. You know, I think you're the first. I know you're the first mixing engineer or engineer period that we've had on the show. And so it's nice that
And I have to say, I am a huge fan of yours and a huge fan of your academy. I've bought almost all the courses and I love them. I love the people. I love the community. Like, I love your book. Like, I recommend it to everybody. So I just want to give you enormous props for what you do and bring to this community and just dispelling all of this stuff and making it easier for everyone to understand. And it's a real treat to turn the... I really came to, if I can do one last little tiny thing, came to year to ATA by way of just because I've been so fortunate to work in these, you know, major label iconic artists world. When people ask me or used to ask me, you know, what happens now, you know, the independent artists that I would work with on the side, you know, okay, thanks. This sounds amazing, Dana. Like, I love it. Like, what do I do next? You know, I'd just be like, I haven't the slightest idea. Like, that's not my world. And I really got interested in trying to figure that out. And it's been really empowering, both for me and my own little, you know, dabbles with my own music. But more importantly, I feel like because of the stuff that I've learned from you and your teachers in the academy, is like, I can really help the artists that I'm working with. I was on an hour-long call last night with an artist I'm producing. Like, got the first single out, the Spotify is set up. Okay, here's what we got to do. Like, this is, you know, I don't know. I get fired up about too many things. And I don't know. I love it. It's really great to have such
a cool... I really appreciate it. And you have contributed so much to the Academy, and I really appreciate everything that you've brought. You're just such a warm presence in there. And
thanks,
we're
man.
So appreciative of everything you've brought. And it's this wonderful community that everyone is giving and taking and just sharing and lifting everybody else up. And you really embody that. And we really appreciate that.
Thanks,
and the energy that you bring.
I love it.
That's awesome. Thank you. I have one final question that I ask everybody who comes on the show.
Of course you do.
Come on. You know this is coming at you.
I've been like,
what does it mean
nights.
To you? Thinking of what your answer is going to be.
I don't,
what does it mean to you to make it in the new music business, Dana?
Man. This is surreal. I'm looking to my right because I wrote some blabbery notes. I think, you know.
Please.
It's definitely wearing a lot of hats. I'd be remiss, and it's hard not to think about, like, you know, making it meaning, being able to sustain yourself, your family, your rent, you know, your dog food bill, whatever it may be, you know, with music. And it doesn't have to be entirely that. I think that's such a basic answer, but I think that is what it feels like to make it for me. Like, I feel like, I have so many goals and so many more things that I want to do and things I want to learn and all that, but I'm very lucky to feel, I feel like I've made it, in my own little way. My wife and I, like, all we do is freelance music jobs, and we like get to live in LA, and it's all we've ever done. I feel very fortunate to have had the experiences that I've had, and I hope that it continues. But I'm also always aware that, you know, it may not. And I always, you know, say if I end up back in Chicago, you know, bagging groceries at the Jewel Asco, I'll have some great stories to tell. You know, I had a good run.
That's right.
I try to keep that perspective that it can be fleeting, but I'm gonna run with it while it's here. And for me, it just means like wearing a lot of hats and following a lot of learning new stuff. And you know, I was thinking the other night, it's smart that the title of your book about, you know, the new music business, because it's like feels like it's new every few days. You know, new stuff is constantly happening, and I feel like the deeper you go into it, the more it changes. But it's amazing to have you and the community as a resource to hit up and just be like, well, which, you know, anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dana Nielsen, thank you so much. This
thank
has been
you,
great.
Ari.
Thank you.
You're a legend, man. I'm really honored to be here. thank you.
Today's episode was edited by Ari Davids with music by Brassroots District and produced by all the great people at Ari's Take. This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features. Annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out distrokid.com.